What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We are back with a second podcast of this Wednesday afternoon, talking to the big man in charge, the editor of Hardwood Paroxysm, my man Ian Levy. Ian, what's up, man?
Nothing. Thanks for having me on.
It's no problem. I feel like I'm talking to the boss right now.
I'm well aware that I am a poor set part now replacement.
Well,
do my best to stand in.
We will get to talk about part now, because we're going to talk about this past weekend's Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, what I think is the 7th or 8th or 9th, whatever it is, annual conference of nerdery.
It was actually the 10th this year, because they recognized, I think maybe there was like a dozen people who have attended all 10 conferences, and so they had like a little award for them. I think I think those people got T-shirts. So yeah, 10 years.
What a great giveaway! T-shirts. Like, at least they didn't give them like slide rules or something super nerdy. You would have thought, like, maybe, like, you get to play Daryl Morey in ping pong or something, like.
Now, that would be a prize. Morey was one of them, which I thought was weird, because he's, like, one of the conference organizers, so it's like he sort of has to be there, you know? It's not the same sort of accomplishment as somebody who's, like, buying a $500 ticket 10 years in a row.
Well, I would imagine that the people that have been there all 10 years are probably not, A, buying their tickets, B, buying tickets at full price.
Yeah.
Or C, I mean, it's only exploded to that level of cost over the last, like, you know, 3 or 4 years, I think. Because I remember the first time I went, it was actually, like, I had decided to go before I even had started writing myself. And I bought the ticket on my own. I got the student rate because I was in law school at the time. And it was, like, $125 or something like that.
Yeah, it's quite a bit more expensive these days. Luckily, I've been nice enough to get media passes every year, so haven't had to eat that cost. But yeah,
this was actually the second year in a row that I was not there, so I missed out on, you know, the most important aspect of the weekend, the Sloan basketball game, and by that I don't mean the Celtics, and I don't mean, like, you know, basketball at the conference. I mean, like, the people that are NBA nerds that go get together and play basketball. On Thursday night, there's a game. And then I think on Sunday morning, a couple times, there's been a game as well. From what I understand, you did not play. But our man Seth did. And I very much need to know if he's still got the skills from college or if he looked terrible.
From what I've heard, it was an embarrassing showing for Part Now.
Oh,
there
my
was
God.
Supposedly some poster dunks. He was in the poster, but not the featured act on the poster.
Wait,
lots
real
of
quickly.
Turnovers, sloppy defense.
So he was not the one doing the posterizing. Was he posterized, or was he just, like, kind of in the poster, like the guy behind Sean Kemp dunking?
With his eyes wide, like, just out of frame. I think it was probably a little of both. I've heard Noel Hollingsworth, who works for Second Spectrum, supposedly the last 2 years he's sort of been the dominant force. And I know Nate Duncan, who is a big guy.
Nate's like 6'5", so.
Yeah, and strong, too. He's not like a willowy Austin Day kind of tall guy.
No. He has some strength.
Yeah, so supposedly he played pretty well, and I don't know if he played this year. I didn't hear anything about Amin El-Hassan, but I know in years past he has just sort of laid waste to the field.
Yeah, Amin is pretty good. There was you know who's really good is Beckley Mason. He's got like it's sort of like a Damian Lillard style game where it's all, you know, rim attacks and pull up threes behind pick and rolls.
I feel like a few years ago, because, you know, when we used to get credentialed through the True Hoop Network. I feel like a few years ago, there used to be a True Hoop dinner after the pickup game.
Yep.
And I remember getting there right for the True Hoop dinner, and Beckley had, like, his knees iced, like, at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, he had, like, bags of ice on his knees with the Saran wrap wrapped around
him. Oh, yeah, dude, his, like...
Whoa, he must have gone hard.
I came the first or second year that I was there. I came, like, right after I had just come back from my knee surgery. And I'm wearing a knee brace, obviously, to support myself. But it's one of, like, those sleeves with, like, the two metal, like, prongs on the side. And Beckley is wearing, like, this giant contraption on his knee. It was the biggest thing I've ever seen. It was so big. Oh, man. That game is so much fun, though.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I wish I was there. Not necessarily even for the conference. I just want to, like, play in the Thursday night game, hang out for 2 days, play in the Sunday morning game, and come home.
The schmoozing and the conversations are always sort of one of the attractions of the conference. The research papers, the panels, and all that stuff is fun, but sort of getting to not just sort of rub elbows with people, but... there's always a hangout on Thursday evening that a lot of basketball people are at. And just, you know, talk to people. People work for teams. You know, people are talking about stuff, you know, hanging out at the bar. So you're getting insights that you might not get. You might not read people write down or things like that. So, yeah, I always learn a lot when I'm there.
Yeah, that's always definitely the best part. And I think that was, you know, by the time I was... I can't remember if I went 3 or 4 times, but by the last time I was there, I only went into like 2 or 3 presentations the whole time of the conference and spent the rest of the time just trying to talk to people, you know, figure out what are the interesting things they're seeing, what are the interesting things they're working on, things like that. And it's always, usually, it had been, right before the trade deadline. I know this year it was after, so that was always interesting stuff to talk about as well. And we'll get into the papers and stuff, but I want to know, what was the most interesting conversation you had, whether it was, you know, another writer or someone from a team or from the league or whatever? You don't have to say who it was, but the most interesting thing you learned from somebody else that was there and doing the sort of schmoozing and walking around stuff as well.
Conversation with a few of the Nylon Calculus guys, and then a guy who does analytics for a team, and he try not to give it away too much, but he does a lot with sort of scouting prospects, draft prospects, and draft modeling, and then another academic researcher, and it was interesting to. It was a conversation that was very much about player specifics, and it was interesting to sort of talk about numbers and eye tests sort of like right there with, you know, people who have some of the best numbers and are also, you know, educated enough to talk about things sort of from a basketball perspective too. So I learned about a couple European prospects that I'm supposed to keep my eyes on for the next couple of years. Luka Dankacic, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, some things about this year's draft class, about Simmons and Ingram, supposedly the models, just the statistical models love Simmons, but it's sort of hard to account for how bad his team was this year. I think that's
interesting, because one of, like, the bigger developments over the last few years in NBA statistics-wise has been, like, RPM and things like that, which, you know, I don't know the full details, but supposedly account for the quality of players that you're on the floor with and that you're on the floor against. So it's interesting that they haven't figured out a way to do that yet for college players, if that's true about Simmons.
Yeah, I don't know actually if there's adjusted plus-minus models for college. I know...
You can barely even find, like, in box scores, regular plus-minus for college.
Yeah. I imagine something like that is built. Somebody must have that out there. But I know... So, like, at Basketball Reference, you can get box plus minus for college players, but that is based on a regression of NBA regularized adjusted plus minus. Then Daniel Myers, who built box plus minus, he just uses the same coefficients for college and NBA. And he sort of acknowledges that he doesn't have the data to test whether they're completely accurate, and it's probably pretty close, but there's a possibility that certain statistics may be more meaningful in college basketball than they are in the NBA. But most of the draft models that I've seen use a lot of, like, ratio statistics, like turnover percentage and assist percentage and rebound percentage and things like that, or pace-adjusted box score stuff, points per 40 minutes and things like that, and I think they do a pretty good job. But the thing with Simmons is you might be able to separate his overall value, but it's especially noisy on those box score statistics because you don't know, like, how many assists did he lose this year because he made a beautiful pass in transition and it went through somebody's hands and out of bounds, or, you know, he made a beautiful kick out to the corner and the guy, you know, shot an air ball on the three-pointer, or how much better his field goal percentage might be if there had been, you know, better spacing around him or something like that. So that's one of those things that even at the NBA level, plus-minus models don't account for extremely well, or that's sort of one of the things that they maybe don't capture quite as well. Is that context? So not just how you make other people better, but how potentially how other players could be making you worse.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, because those models, I would imagine, they account for the quality of the players on the floor, but not necessarily the context of their specific skill sets. Like, you know, maybe Anthony Davis plays with, good player X, who is better than another player on the team, but isn't as good of a shooter, so it doesn't give him quite as much a space to operate or something like that.
Yeah, and you sort of have two issues. So one, like in the NBA, in Simmons' case too. So a regularized adjusted plus minus model accounts for all of the different possible combinations on your team. But if all of your teammates are terrible, it's going to sort of naturally depress your numbers. And then the other thing is context. So, like, you know, a couple of years ago, Patty Mills, one of his first 2 years with the Spurs, he, by plus-minus models, he looked like one of the best point guards in the NBA. And the implication was not that he is actually one of the best point guards in the NBA. It's that in that constrained role that he plays with the Spurs, he is that effective, or his impact is that large in that narrowly constrained role. But if you put Patty Mills on the 76ers this year, he's not going to look nearly as good, because he's going to have to do way more than he does in San Antonio.
Right. That makes sense too. And then, you know, you mentioned also, you know, the contextual differences just between all the different teams that you have to account for. Like, you look at a team like Virginia that plays at like a 50 or 60 possession a game pace or whatever it is. And then, you know, just in their same conference, North Carolina is pushing the ball up the floor like a million times a game. Even something like points per 40 minutes or whatever it is, it's going to be vastly different. You know, you look at the NBA, the biggest difference in possessions per game is, you know, like 8 or 9 possessions or something. There could be like 20, 30 possession differences with these college teams.
Yeah, I think the range of possibilities is a lot bigger in the college game. You know, as much as we appreciate the statistical differences or the stylistic differences between NBA teams, you know, the Warriors are much more similar to the 76ers than, you know, the best teams in college basketball are to, you know, the worst teams in college basketball.
Right, that makes sense. And I wanted to go back to what you said about, like, the context of teammates and stuff, because that was one of the NBA-related papers as well, was accounting for complementary skill sets when evaluating NBA players' values to a specific team. That's something that I think we talk about a lot. Like, you want shooters to play with pick-and-roll point guards and with, you know, knifing big men through the lane, things like that. Was there anything in particular that stood out for you from that topic as something that, you know, might be interesting that you've learned?
Well, a few things. One of the things sort of overall that was most interesting for me about this year's conference, and one of the reasons that I thought it was a lot better than the past two specifically was those two research papers, that one and the one about screening, which I think we're going to talk about in a minute, is it seemed like they really built on work that I remember seeing at the conference in other years. In the past couple of years, I feel like you've seen these amazing presentations, these really interesting things. And the piece that's sort of missing is is sort of like the functional implication. Like, what do you actually do with this? And then nobody ever sort of builds on it, or it doesn't come back up, or, you know, maybe a team invests in the researchers who are doing it, or it's, you know, like those Second Spectrum guys who go out on their own, and then it just sort of disappears and you never sort of see the extension of it. So the first year I went to the conference, there was a couple really interesting papers. So there was one about the impact of experience and having an experienced player in lineups, how that could sort of separated from their skill set or their production, but having somebody who's experienced could impact the lineup. And then there was two different presentations where they sort of clustered players by skill type, right, and then looked at how different combinations of different player clusters. So essentially, instead of looking at people as five positions, maybe there's 10 or 12 positions. So you appreciate like the nuance between a stretch four and a big who just sort of rebounds and protects the rim, and looking at those different combinations. So that work was pretty rudimentary, and I thought this was interesting. It dealt with specific skill sets as opposed to sort of like players as a combination of skills. So it was interesting. We talked a little bit about it on the Nylon Calculus email thread. We sort of read through the paper before the conference. We were talking about it with a few people. What much smarter people than me said was that it was a really interesting sort of like approach methodology, but that it could have been done, maybe with more insightful statistics, or sort of like a more sort of complete or comprehensive way. But I thought it was an interesting
framework. What do you mean by that?
Framework, and it was what the Nylon Calculus people said.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, it was done with some sort of basic box score measures, and that there was and the output was sort of the output was expected value in a scale that maybe was not necessarily intuitive. There was some talk about sort of taking that framework. This is going back a few years, but there's people who have used the framework of adjusted plus minus, and have used that with the variable, instead of being the overall impact on your team, the variable is your team's field goal percentage, or your team's defensive field goal percentage, things like that. It's been called like four factors plus minus. Lane Vachereau had it at Nylon Calculus for a while before he got snapped up by the Nuggets, and we had to take it down. But so I think the ramification was that you could use this framework, which was sort of simulating a full game, and apply that to like four factors type statistics, and maybe get a more accurate picture than the previous work, which sort of used this regression framework, this plus-minus regression framework. And that the methodology of this paper, which sort of used game simulations as the way of getting from point A to point B, that might provide a more nuanced picture. But that the output of like a four factors plus minus, you put this guy on the court and he increases your team's field goal percentage by 3% or whatever, something like that, that might have been a more useful sort of output at the end.
Okay, so more specific, basically, rather than, you know, expected value, which, you know, makes sense in terms of, you know, an overall comprehensive view, but it's better to know in which specific ways certain kinds of players might help others.
Yeah. I think they were not. I think the implication from the Nylon Calculus people was not that this this other sort of model or this other output would have been better, but ideally you would want to have both pieces put together. So something that comes up a lot at Sloan, and sort of what I was alluding to before, is like that this is a, this paper was really interesting, but it was also a step towards, you know, a larger goal, and you know, being able to sort of see the larger goal not that far in the distance and feel like that, that next step is even more useful.
Yeah, that, that definitely makes sense, and that's something I think you run into also, because I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, there's a page limit on these papers. You can't just have it go like 50 pages or whatever, so there's a bit of a constraint there. And then also one of the things I remember from when I was going to the conference, you know, was that people were always talking about, like, it's good that we have all this information, but we also need to figure out how to communicate it to coaches, how to communicate it to players, and turn it into something that's actionable. And that, that always felt like something that was a bit of a struggle, because when I was going there, it was always like, okay, let's, here's more tracking data stuff, and it's all descriptive of things that have happened in the past. Like, for example, a lot of the work that, that Kirk Goldsberry did, you know, I was there for his first conference when he debuted sort of the hexagonal shot chart type of things. And that was all, that it was great, and I was blown away when I saw it. And it was all descriptive of things that had happened in the past. Then he took it a step further with the same thing, but for defense and the rim protection. Like, this is what, you know, Dwight Howard's defensive shot chart looks like. And I remember that was a topic that one year. And then I know that he did another paper on, you know, defense, like shot defense for not just around the basket, but for players in total. And then there was some sort of like expected value thing of, you know, decisions you make at certain times in a certain play and how that affects, again, expected value. And that's all, again, it's all good work, and I found it all very interesting, but it was all, again, descriptive. And that's the challenge is, and he said it in his talks every year, was, you know, the challenge is to now make this actionable for players. Now, obviously, he's trying to find a way to do that with the Spurs.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that sort of struck me this year is it's that conversation happens in large part every year is how do we make this actionable? And I know that I and some of the other people who go to the conference regularly have often felt frustrated because you go to these panels and nobody really talks about specifics. They spend a lot of time talking about, like, the important thing is how do we make this actionable and how do we communicate it? And nobody ever sort of gets into that nitty gritty. And the more I've sat in on those conversations, the more I realize they can't really talk about the nitty gritty because it's not a one size fits all solution. And the work that's being done on how do you communicate those things is being done at the organizational level with teams, and it's not stuff they can or want to talk about because they don't want to give up their competitive advantage. And so as I've gotten to know more people who work with teams and sort of hearing about their situations and the work they do and how it's structured, it's really striking how differently every organization deals with this. I mean, we know that increasingly teams are invested in analytics. We know that, like, at this point, I think every team has at least one sort of designated analytics person on staff, but the environments in which those people work are so completely different. Like, some teams have analytics staff that does almost completely front office stuff, like player evaluation, player value versus projected contract value, draft projections, sort of analyzing trades and things like that. And then you have people on the other end of the spectrum who their analytics staff is devoted to working on sort of like nitty-gritty strategy stuff, in-game things, lineup combinations, defensive strategies. And there are teams that sort of do both. But then there's also sort of like a real like organizational thing. Like, some analytics people communicate directly with the coaching staff. Some analytics people, whatever the work they're doing gets filtered through somebody else in the front office who's then communicating it to the coaching staff. I can't remember which team it was, but somebody was talking to this weekend said that their analytics, the analytics staff for that team is actually like in a completely separate office space. Like the team's offices are in this building and there's maybe some other businesses that share office space in there. And the analytics staff is like not even it's not even like physically in the proximity of anybody else who works for the team. They sort of work completely separately. So they got to, in reality, maybe that's not a huge thing. They got to walk across the building to, you know, or go up two floors to go to a meeting, but it sort of speaks to the idea that analytics is sort of separate from everything else that's going on with the team. And then there are some teams who have analytics people, but the bulk of their analytics people aren't even in house. You know, there's teams who sort of specifically deal with like outsourced consultants, and people are working on projects remotely and, you know, dropping by the facility here and there. And so that question of how do we make this actionable, that's something that I feel like is sort of kept away from the public because everybody's sort of figuring it out differently and they don't, you know, they don't want anybody else to know how they're figuring it out.
That's always the topic that sort of dominates the conference too. It permeates like every single talk, no matter what sport or what topic it is. You know, how do we turn this into something that works for us as a team, as a league, as a, you know, consultancy, whatever. The team you were thinking of with the off-site analytics crew, I mean, listen, you don't have to tell me who it was, but that sure sounds like the Lakers' super secret analytics staff that nobody
was
sure.
It was actually not the Lakers. I don't know what the Lakers' setup is. But this team with the analytics staff in a different part of the building, and this was something secondhand. I wasn't talking to somebody who worked for the team. I was talking to somebody from Nylon Calculus who knew somebody who worked for the team, or maybe he had interviewed for a job with this team. I don't even actually remember how the information came. But I can say that it was a team that I would think of as being analytically invested, as a team that is implementing analytics strategies, and a team that is a team that you can sort of see the impact of their investment in analytics on the court, what's happening on the court.
That makes sense. What were the Nylon guys up to there?
Everybody's sort of there doing their own thing. We only got two media passes, and that was me and Seth. So everybody else who was there, paid their own way. And so people are, you know, they're a great group of guys. They're smart. We don't have a budget at Nylon Calculus to pay people for their work. Everybody's doing it for fun and because they love it. So some people are just there to have a good time, to interact with you know, other people in the field, to check out the papers and sort of satisfy curiosity. And, you know, for some of the guys, it's about schmoozing and making connections and hopefully getting a job with the team. In the past year, two of our guys, Kevin Farragan and Krishna Narsu, have both started internships with the Mavs analytics staff. And then Lane Vacherow, who I mentioned earlier, he got a job. And it's actually, I said the Nuggets earlier, but it's actually with the Kroenke Sports Group. I can't remember what the company's technically called. But his position's really interesting, and they talked about it a little bit at the football analytics panel because they own multiple teams. And so Lane works with Sandy Wheel, and they're in a separate office, and they are sort of working on analytics for all the multiple sports teams that the group owns. And then each individual sports team also has their own separate analytics staff. So Lane sort of works in the central office, and then the Nuggets also have their own analytics staff. And so there's sort of some communication back and forth there. But I think that's also really interesting. You think about sort of the exchange of ideas and maybe taking like a football or a soccer or a hockey analytic concept and applying it to a basketball framework.
Right, because they own the Kroenkes, they own the Rams, they own the Colorado Avalanche, they own, I can't remember which soccer team, all in addition to the Nuggets. So they own a team in, you know, four of the five three of the four major American sports, and then also the biggest sport in the world.
And he said at the panel that I saw him at Stan, he said that they had made an offer on the Dodgers and got outbid
by Magic Johnson's group, I guess.
Yeah, so they were looking for the flush there, the full house.
Right. That it's interesting too with the Nylon guys, because those guys, I mean, I'm on that email thread that you guys have. I understand like 5% of what the hell you guys are talking about. And I consider myself fairly well versed compared to a lot of other people in a lot of this stuff. And some of it just goes so far over my head in terms of like the technical, you know, how I guess they arrive at the things that they wind up writing. But yeah. the stuff that I actually understand, it's such like high level thinking that it makes me so much smarter.
Yeah, well, I'm not that far ahead of you. I'm maybe at like 8 or 9% that I understand. But it's been interesting to me this year, especially as the staff has grown and we have some new skill sets in the group. There's sort of like two threads that are like way above my head. There's like the math and the statistical thread that I like don't understand, and then there's the sort of the software computing, coding, web scraping side.
Yeah, that thing, I just delete all the emails because I'm like, I'm never going to understand this.
But I one of the things I really appreciate about that group, and sometimes it, you know, sometimes it takes a little nudging for Seth because it's sort of like one of his mantras, but I think the guys that we have there are very good at not letting things sort of spiral in abstract directions. Like, everyone's really good at, I have this thick mathematical idea, and I'm going to bring it back to basketball. And, you know, talking about the research papers, like, I think people do a really good job of taking a big thing, a big idea, a big project, and at the end of our posts, sort of coming back to, and here's what you would do with this, or, and here's what this means for a game, or this player, or this team. So I would commend the group on that, because I know it's not always in everybody's sort of natural wheelhouse, but they do a really good job at that.
Definitely. And I mean, it's interesting too, because a lot of them are coming from not necessarily a place of writing about the work they do usually. It's just, this is, you know, the kind of mathematical and research type of work that they do, and now they are writing about it. And I always find it interesting to see how those specific guys communicate the things that they come up with too.
Yeah, and they've gotten, there's a few who I think have gotten to be, not that they were bad writers before, but there's a few that I think of now as like really good writers. Like, they could write basketball stuff without any stats and it would still be really interesting and engaging. Andrew Johnson in particular is one of my favorite guys there to read. He sort of has that full package. He does really sort of dense, thoughtful stats stuff, and his writing is just sort of really light and funny and engaging. And I know he's worked really hard on that.
Did any of them submit papers for the conference? I know them. Looking at the names, none of them.
I think Krishna in the past has talked about submitting work. I don't know that he's actually ever submitted anything. My sense is from talking to a few of the other people. So I think what they take like 12 papers maybe each year for the conference, and so a handful of those are basketball. I think this year there was only 2 basketball papers. Other years there's been like 3 or 4. That 12 papers are split up among all the different sports that people submit. But I would imagine they get hundreds and hundreds of submissions. And so even if you're a smart guy doing really thoughtful work, the odds are pretty long.
Yeah. That definitely makes sense. Plus, you know, the work they do is put into the public space. And I know from being on the thread with you guys that they're all, you know, very interested or invested in, you know, being able to share things with people. I know that that's not necessarily a complaint, but a concern that they have with some of the work that gets done elsewhere is that a lot of the research behind it or the data behind it isn't accessible, so there's not able to be checks on it. So also I would imagine that submitting papers for something like this, you know, and it's not necessarily the work behind it becoming public, would not necessarily align with a lot of their views.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's hard because we sort of, like everybody who sort of arrives in this field organically from the outside, you know, you do some other job where you have a statistical background and you're a basketball fan and you naturally sort of, you know, translate the two. It's the stats community, although it can be prickly and there's personalities and egos and stuff. I would say generally it's this very welcoming sort of like open source community, and people want to share their work. They want to solicit feedback. They want to offer thoughts on other people's work, not to nitpick or to sort of tear it down. But everybody in this field is really curious and they want to learn as much as they can. And that's the work that they do and the work that they're getting from other people. And so that is sort of necessarily at odds with the fact that the financial incentives behind this field are that the best work is going to end up being done in private. I guess I shouldn't say the best work, because there's a lot of public work that's really, really good, but that there is this piece where money is going to make sure a lot of the work is done in private. I don't know. I've never actually talked to anybody in Ion Calculus about this, but I wonder if there's – I'm sure most of them would be happy to take a full-time job at a healthy salary and do their work in private. But I wonder what that sort of moral dilemma would feel like for some of them to have been doing this work in public and be a part of this community for a couple years and then be like, all right, I can't talk about the work I do anymore with all of these people. I'm going to trade – being a part of this community for having somebody that's sort of having somebody that owns a team act on, you know, my recommendations and my thoughts and my research.
Right. And I would imagine, you know, that's something that you could ask like Lane or Kevin or Krishna about, because they're the ones that actually have been doing that. I mean, I don't know if all of their work is now private. I know Lane's stuff was taken off the site and he hasn't been, I don't think, really active on that thread at all this season, but it's definitely an interesting dilemma. And I do want to move on to, though, the second basketball-related paper from the conference, because I think it's maybe the most interesting in terms of actual gameplay paper, basketball-wise, that there's been at the conference, because it was all about pick-and-roll defense, which is, you know, maybe the most important aspect of defense, period, these days.
This paper I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, I gave it a once over, and, you know, don't necessarily understand all of the issues. So, if, you know, if you could synthesize what you learned, you know, what would that be?
So the sort of the summary of the paper is that this group built software, so they take the raw sport view data, the optical tracking data from the cameras and all the arenas, they take the raw form of that data, and with machine learning, they trained their software to recognize when a screen has occurred, and then to recognize the specific defensive scheme that has been used to defend that screen. And they said that was most... some of it had to do with the size of their data set that they trained the software on. And obviously the things that happen more frequently, they're more accurate at spotting. So they said having a defender go over a screen, having a defender go under a screen, or having the two defenders switch a screen, those were the things that they could sort of really, really get precise with. And then they can, obviously, because it's this optical tracking data, they can then attach the identities of the two defenders and the two offensive players to the action. So you can look at, different defensive screen combinations and what strategies are most effective for different pairs of players, and then how those pairs of players match up against specific offensive players. So you could really have something as granular as, if you've got Hassan Whiteside and Joe Johnson defending a screen, you want Whiteside to drop back and you want Johnson to go under, unless the offensive combination is these types of players, and then you want Whiteside to hedge and you want Johnson to fight over it. So it's sort of... it provides a really specific level of data. And one of the things was most exciting for me about this paper, and I was talking about the other one too, was it built on previous work. And specifically, 2 years ago, there was a paper, I actually had to look it up to see when it was, but there was a paper 2 years ago that was presented at the conference, and the paper was just machine learning software that can use the SportView data set and recognize screens with 80% accuracy.
Yep, I remember that paper. That was the last conference I went to.
Yeah, and that was sort of the whole thing, and people were like, making fun of it on Twitter, and people talking in the hallways like, wow, congratulations, like, you can measure screens with 80% accuracy. You're like, woo! And so now it's like, 2 years later, they can do that and attach the identity of the four players involved and specifically identify the defensive scheme. And it's been so rare in my experience at the conference to see an idea presented and then sort of see that logical extension, see like the follow-up work that's done to sort of make it into something that's like really, really useful. And you know, we were talking about how you translate this into actionable evidence. Like, this is like, this, there's no advanced math here. There's advanced math in the software, but in the actual results, like, this is something that would be totally accessible and understandable for anybody involved in basketball. You know, it could be like, hey, when these two guys defend a screen, if he goes under, we give up 0.8 points per possession, and if he goes over, we give up 0.6 points per possession. So we should go over more than we go under. I mean, it's like it's a complex thing that boils down to something really simple and useful.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was interesting about the paper too, like, there were three diagrams in the middle that sort of it charted, you know, the percentage of time certain ball handlers were guarded with switches, with their defender going over, with their defender going under, and when you looked at where the players fell on all the different graphs, one of the interesting things to me was, players went over against LeBron less often than pretty much any other player. But, you know, he was around 0.9 points per possession on those, which was one of the highest. I think it was second highest. I'm looking at it now. Second highest to only Pablo Prigioni was the only one that was higher. But then you look at the other guys who were in with a low percentage of the defenders going over the screen, and they were all very high in defenders going under the screen. It was Michael Carter-Williams, John Wall, Ramon Sessions, Ricky Rubio. But LeBron was not high among that group. And he was very high in terms of, he was the highest. Nobody got their pick and roll switched more than LeBron. But then you look at that, and he was around like 0.85 points per possession. So it's not like it made a huge amount of difference switching as opposed to going over. And then when they went under, which he was, you know, towards the middle of the group, he killed those even more, which was surprising to me because, you know, his jumper is relatively the weakest part of his game. So those kind of things, you know, being able to look at where all those guys fell in the different, I guess you would call them like matrices, was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, there was all sorts of interesting insights. I mean, obviously, one of the things was their data set that they did all of this work with was last year's data set. So they had a lot of numbers on Curry and Green, and I think all of those numbers were from last year, so I can't even imagine what they would look like this year. But they talked about how as a league-wide trend, people are going over the screen more and more and more. I think they have 4 or maybe 3 years of full SportView data. And they just talked about this steady increase, right? So we're seeing this effect as three-point rates are going up around the league. It's changing how teams are defending. And then when you sort of have that aggregated data, you could sort of take it to the next step, right? So you know, 3-point rates are going up, and then we have this next piece of information that defenses are adjusting in a certain way. So then maybe there's some sort of offensive adjustment that comes off that sort of that takes advantage of that increasing defensive trend.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense because as the league is being populated with better and better shooters, you want to go under screens less because you don't want to give those guys the space to be able to just pull up and take a three. I mean, you know, I just did this piece recently on the differences between Damian Lillard and Stephen Curry. And one of those aspects was, you know, the ways that they're each guarded in the pick and roll. And what surprised me a lot was that teams are going over the screen more often against Lillard than they are against Curry. But that's only because they're trying so much different shit to stop Curry, because they don't trust the defender to just try to get over the screen. So they switch like almost three times as often on Curry pick and rolls as they do on Lillard, where they just try to have their guy fight over.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, the numbers from this paper, the over-under split on Curry and Green was not nearly as big as you would think, because Green has gotten so good at catching the ball on the move and making decisions in the middle of the floor, that it really sort of illustrated that point of, like, their pick and roll is sort of unguardable, because either way you play it, they sort of can beat you in an efficient way. Yeah, I wish I could remember the numbers off the top of my head. The presentation had a few numbers that weren't in the paper.
Yeah, because I'm looking through the paper and Draymond's not mentioned in the actual paper, but I would imagine that they had obviously numbers on it. You know, that's how they started. The paper was talking about Steph Curry pick and rolls and how he gets his threes. So obviously, you know, that's maybe the biggest issue in the league right now is how to stop that particular action just between those two guys. And everybody talks about it. You know, they had J.J. Redick on his first podcast. They had like a 10-minute discussion with him and Jared Dudley on different strategies for trying to guard the Steph Curry, Draymond Green pick and roll. Like, everybody talks about it. It's ridiculous.
There's not any easy answers there, obviously.
Yeah, I really think that
even the stat nerds don't have one.
There's no answer, honestly. It's just, you can't actually guard it other than, like, hoping they miss, which is, you know, obviously not a good strategy in itself. Was there anything else that you found just particularly interesting, things that you learned, people that you talked to?
Goldsberry gave a really interesting talk. And it was, he had agreed to give the talk, a couple months ago. So before he had gotten his position with the Spurs, so he sort of had to change what he was going to talk about. He sort of had to narrow his focus to something perhaps a little less sort of useful. But he talked about Steph Curry and moving the 3-point line. And I did not listen to the, I guess he was on Simmons' podcast a couple weeks ago, and I guess he shared some of these ideas. And I had missed that podcast, so I had heard them before, but I thought it was really fascinating. So the talk was sort of, if you were going to use data to do something other than just move the 3-point line back a static distance, what would that look like, and what would the implications be? So his two ideas, I thought, he sort of admitted, he both said these are totally unreasonable, and I don't think we need to move the line because I really like watching the Spurs, and I don't think there's anything wrong with the aesthetics of beautiful passing and three-pointers. But he said, you know, just for curiosity, I sort of came up with these two things. So the first one was that instead of the 3-point line being a static distance, you make it a contour line that marks where the league average is 33.3%. So it would be maybe a little bit further back in the corners instead of a little bit closer, and you might have some nuanced differences between the left side of the court and the right side of the court. I don't think he specifically said it in the presentation, but I think the implication was that it would get adjusted semi-regularly. So maybe at the end of every season, the 3-point line sort of gets redrawn in a different place. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, because that would sort of level the advantage for everybody. You know, if it's a sort of a static distance, there are spots where there's an increased advantage. There are spots like the corners where it's You know, it's easier to make a three-pointer. Often that's because of the geometry and the defenders can't recover as well. But it would sort of even out all of those sort of spatial advantages, and it would make the advantage by shooting percentage. And then his other idea was to let each team sort of within reason, within a range of possibilities, put the three-point line wherever they want it in their home arena, sort of like how in baseball, you know, outfield dimensions are different depending on the park. And I thought that one was really interesting, too. The ramifications of watching how each team chooses to sort of set that line and then either build their roster towards it or look at the roster they have now and set the line. That's one that he's written about before.
He wrote about that idea for Grantland, I believe.
Yeah, and that one was really interesting to me. And somebody else said it would be really interesting if teams had the option of just not having the three-point line.
Right, so like Memphis would get rid of it.
If you gave them the full, you know, sort of the full range of control, would some teams just take the three-point line away? Which I think is a really interesting question. So that, I think, watching teams actually play would be interesting, but also watching how teams sort of answer that question for themselves would be really interesting, too.
That particular idea also would be really interesting to watch, like, how it would affect in-season trades. Because, like, if you had to set the three-point line at the start of the year, and then all of a sudden you made a trade and it completely changed the dynamic of your team, and now you had to play with a different team than you planned on with the three-point line in a different place than where it would make sense for the new version of your team, that would be really interesting to watch, I think. The last thing I want to know is, what kinds of things, like let's say you go back next year, what do you want to see there, basketball-wise? Like, what's the idea to you that you think should be, that someone should be working on that would not necessarily be, you know, the big breakthrough, but something that's sort of actionable and would help?
I know there's a lot of progression being made on the, like, the biometric side and the physical data. I went to a few different presentations the first morning about biometrics and, like, wearable technology that tracks physical things. That stuff was really interesting. A lot of the implication stuff go over my head. Like, the first one I went to was sort of a business presentation. So the guy was talking about their lab and their technology, and he was talking about how they are using wearables to predict injuries. And according to his statistics, I think most of their clients are Major League Baseball players, but they said last year they had prevented like 99 injuries. I don't know how you would verify that you had prevented an injury.
You can't prove a negative.
Yeah, but that thing clearly is, if you could sort of magically wave a wand and use technology and statistical analysis to solve one problem, like that one's really obvious because it doesn't change the style of play. It doesn't change the aesthetics. It doesn't make any. It doesn't make anybody in an organization obsolete. It doesn't push old coaches out or anything like that. It's just like, hey, if we could figure out how to get every player healthy for an entire season and allow them to sort of play at the peak that their bodies will allow them, like that's like a win-win-win. That's better for fans, better for players, better for teams, better for everybody. So I think that is interesting. I think the work that's being done there and the discussion about it is not super interesting, at least to me. Like I said, these biometric presentations that I went to, a lot of it went right over my head because I don't have sort of like a physiology background. So they're talking about load and explosiveness and drive off of jumps and all these things, and don't totally understand it. I think the more the conference can deal with nitty-gritty, and I know that's sort of the biggest challenge because the most interesting people to talk to are the people who are doing this work right now and are doing it for teams, and they're necessarily limited in what they can talk about. But the more people can share about what things look like at their organization, that's really interesting to me. And then dealing with sort of big, I'd like to see more discussion of big sort of like philosophical issues. One of the best things that I've seen, and this was my fifth year, and one of the best things I've seen at the conference was a one-on-one a couple years ago with Malcolm Gladwell.
Yep.
And the, I can't remember the guy's name, and the guy who wrote the book The Sports Gene, and the conversation was basically like, Malcolm Gladwell has this like 10,000 hours theory, which is sort of like the nurture school of thought, and this other guy had this book about research into athletics being derived from your genes, and so he was sort of like the nature standpoint, and that conversation didn't solve anything. There's no ramifications for teams or how anybody's going to, you know, do business on Monday morning, but that was a fascinating conversation.
So you're way more altruistic than I am with your ideas. Mine is, I just want to see the thing that I've been trying to get an answer to for like 4 years. How offensive efficiency is affected by how quickly the team gets into their offense. This is something that Seth and I have talked about on the podcast. I've talked about it on other people's podcasts. I've talked about it with people from Stats LLC, which runs the SportView cameras. Basically, you know, so let's say you get the ball over half court with 20 seconds left on the shot clock. You now have 20 seconds to run your offense. But if you get the ball over with 17 seconds on the shot clock, you only have 17 seconds to run your offense. And those 3 seconds are worth X amount of points per 100 possessions. And as the clock keeps ticking down, that's each worth X points per 100 possessions. And, you know, let's say you get over half court, but you just have somebody standing there trying to enter the ball into the post for 4 or 5 seconds. That lowers your offensive efficiency by X amount. And, you know, then you can hook it up to on-off data. How fast does this team get the ball over half court or get into their offense with this point guard running the offense or with that point guard running the offense or with Avery Bradley on the floor for the defense or when he's not on the floor? How much is it affected by whether or not Avery Bradley is actually pressuring the ball in the backcourt? You know, you can do all kinds of things once you hook up that SportView data to the shot clock and figure out where the ball is at certain times, figure out what actually initiating the offense looks like. That's something that I've been trying to do, and I've talked about it with Seth and a bunch of other people a bunch of times. That's what I want to see. And, you know, whether...
I mean, I think there is a sort of an established correlation between offensive initiation and offensive efficiency.
Oh, everybody knows that it exists. I've just never seen it measured other than like by the time of the shot. Like obviously shots earlier in the clock go in more than shots later in the clock, but I've never seen, you know, the actual crossing the 3-point line, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, I know SportView has, in their reports, it's not public on NBA, but in their reports that they share with teams, because they have this contract with the league, I know that they track the average time for each offense and defense. I think it's crossing half court, or I have seen some of that.
But yeah, so I know it's not the kind of thing that's...
I don't remember, but that expected... The paper that you were talking about with Goldsberry and the grad students that he worked with a couple of years ago that sort of measured things as a decision tree and the expected value change. So if Tony Parker's got the ball at the top of the key and he passes it to Kawhi Leonard in the corner, then what's the expected value and what's the change between Parker having the ball in his hands and Leonard having the ball in his hands? And if I remember correctly, I think that paper only dealt with actions like that, decisions. So if he dribbles from here to here, if he passes the ball to somebody else, where the ball is located. But it would be interesting if there was a chronological component in there. So just, you know, obviously bringing the ball across half court changes the expected value of the possession. But if you get the, I mean, from that, if that was integrated in their framework, if Tony Parker gets to this spot in 4 seconds as opposed to 6 seconds, how does that change the expected value?
And maybe right.
That
was just naturally, it has to. Because if Kawhi Leonard gets the ball in the corner with 1 second left on the shot clock, he has to shoot. But if he gets the ball in the corner with 12 seconds left on the shot clock, he has a whole bunch of different options. You know, he can shoot, he can put it on the floor, he can post up, he could throw it back to the top. You know, just naturally, the points per possession expected has to change. You know, whether it's positive or negative, it's 100%, it has to be different.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you're right. I didn't even think about that. But so it must have been embedded in there somewhere. So then I guess that system is your answer. They would probably be able to generalize it. But I remember one of the frustrations with that system was it's really cool. It's not necessarily functionally usable because they had to run it through. They had to run it through like a supercomputer on the Harvard campus to do the calculations because it was so calculation intensive. So it's like, well, you're not going to have that like in the hands of an assistant coach in an iPad like on the sidelines during the game.
No. Like, I don't think this would be like that either. You know, certainly not like during the game, like, oh, we have to pressure this ball handler. But it would be something that you could come into the game with. Like, if you can make them shave seconds off the shot clock, like, obviously everyone knows that anyway. But being able to say exactly how much it's worth and, you know, how or just know how certain players affect that kind of thing could affect free agency valuations or things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting question. Somebody somewhere must be working on it, or teams must have that.
It has to be such something.
A fundamental question.
Yeah, and if you can pair it with all kinds of things, on off data, lineup data, you know, specific ball handlers having the ball in specific places, things like that. I mean, there's so much you can do with it once you get it hooked up to that initial, you know, initiating the offense or crossing a certain point on the court, whatever, hooked up with the shot clock. From there, you can take it in so many different directions. But that's just me, because it's an idea that I've had, and I'm selfish, and that's what I want to see. And you actually want to help people with preventing injuries and stuff. And that's why you are in charge of the network, and I'm just the guy that used to be.
Well, I'll take your question and I'll push it out there. I'll see if we can get you an answer next year.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for talking to me about this. Really appreciate it. Do you want to let everyone know where they can find not just the HP basketball stuff, but all of your work wherever and on Twitter and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Hickory High. Stuff at HP, stuff at Nylon Calculus. The good people at Vice are letting me do a really fun series this year where I take rookies and pick three sort of random players who have some sort of aesthetic similarity, and they let me just sort of meander for 1,000 words, and then they slap a beautiful illustration on top. So check those out. Devin Booker coming tomorrow.
Awesome. Thank you again, man. Everyone can check out all of the HP Basketball Network podcasts on hardwoodparoxysm.com. If you click on the link for the podcast center at the top of the page, we are on iTunes. If you search for HP Basketball Network or Hardwood Paroxysm, search for the name of this podcast, Quo Vadimus. I'm at JADubin5 on Twitter. And thanks for listening. Ian, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks a lot, Jared.